The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason. And I'm looking forward to the next 3 hours of chatting with you about the most important things we can be talking about: ethics, values, and religion. My number, 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150, direct. Just got back from Charlotte last evening. Drove into my driveway at about 10:15, and that would have been like 1:15 in the morning Charlotte time. But I had a great time the last 4 days with Frank Turek and the boys at the CIA, the Cross-Examine Instructors Academy, where I have been serving with him for the last 4 years. This is our fourth year together, and this promises not to be the last, from what I can tell. It's a great time together, but it's great to not only train other Christians to be more effective communicators by giving particular talks in defense of Christianity, and that's what CIA is all about. But it's also great to rub shoulders with colleagues and with people who are kindred spirit, and in a way that kind of gets everybody excited about the stuff and the material and what we're doing, and giving us a kind of a, maybe sometimes a different perspective on things, and giving us insight on some things, and altogether getting us fired up to move out and continue to extend the kingdom as better ambassadors for Christ. Something came up in the discussion or in the teaching that prompted some reflection on my part on the issue of bullying, and I want to start out the show by talking about that a little bit. And I don't mean, by the way, here physical bullying. I know there's a lot of emphasis in that in public schools nowadays, or at least one aspect of it, and this isn't what I'm speaking of. What I mean is academic or intellectual bullying. And there were two areas that we touched on where speakers addressed issues in which I think this is happening, and followers of Christ need to be apprised of this principally, so that they are not bullied into silence in at least two areas here. One of them is in the area of archaeology, and I listened to just a fascinating presentation on biblical archaeology and some new things that have been discovered about the flood, not the flood, but the about the Exodus and archaeological evidence that corroborates scripture. And one of the points that was being made, by the way, was the role of archaeology, and that there's a certain sense that archaeology proper does not prove the Bible on its own, or prove our convictions on their own, but what they serve as points of corroboration on the reliability, the historical reliability of the text, by showing that certain events took place, or that certain people existed, or that certain places existed, or that there are certain roles identified in Scripture that actually were functional roles of the ancient Near East, or maybe that certain groups of people existed that maybe the Bible records, but nothing else corroborates. And so you've got these touchstones of corroboration that give more credibility to the Bible. But see, when you try to do this, there's some pushback you're going to get. And it is a standard kind of pushback that the academic community has offered here. I have the professor who gave the talk offered his own citations regarding this, but I had my own. And from Biblical Archaeology Review, Menahem Mansour, a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, in the area of biblical archaeology made this particular point. He says that biblical archaeology has failed to deter people who seek to validate religious concepts by archaeological finds. These people should not confuse fact with faith, history with tradition, or science with religion. Israel Finkelstein, the co-director of excavations at Tel Megiddo, professor of archaeology at Tel Aviv University, said in kind here, the most obvious failure of archaeology has been the abuse of the old biblical archaeology by semi-amateur archaeologists. I refer to the Romantic days when a special breed of archaeologists roamed the Middle East with spade in one hand and scriptures in the other. These were the times of desperate attempts to prove that the Bible was correct. And so here you've got major players in the field, and my quotes are older. The professor's quote, Ted's quote, quotes a couple of days ago, were much more recent. And in fact, the more recent quotes are more aggressive. You can't use biblical archaeology to prove the Bible. I mean, this is an illicit use of the discipline. Now, what's curious about these challenges, or I should say these statements, these declarations, is that these same people affirm that archaeology in the Middle East has, in many cases, and I should probably say routinely, verified or validated particular things that the Old Testament scriptures have said which were not previously validated. So we see a people's mention, like the Hittites, for example, and there was no separate archaeological evidence for Hittites, and so their existence was in doubt, and then, sure enough, additional archaeological evidence is uncovered that shows the Hittites actually existed. So you've got now a point of verification. Curiously, the separate archaeological evidence, in this case, I think it was actually some kind of a stele, a stone inscription, a stone object with inscriptions on it that indicated the existence of the Hittites. It's curious that that written piece of information from antiquity counts as historical evidence, and the biblical account doesn't count as historical evidence until it's verified by some additional source. And this happens all the time, so the Bible is kind of treated in a special category. But the point that I'm making is, as a matter of fact, the historical details of the Bible are routinely reinforced or corroborated by archaeological evidence. And ironically, the same people that excoriate Christian archaeologists for using the archaeology to prove the Bible at the same time are the people who are acknowledging the fact that the Bible does indeed benefit from archaeology. I read the citation from Menahem Mansour a few moments ago. Biblical archaeology has failed to deter people who seek to validate religious concepts by archaeological finds. Let me tell you the sentence that comes just before that. That sentence is this: biblical archaeology's greatest significance is that it has corroborated many historical records in the Bible. Next sentence: biblical archaeology has failed to deter people who seek to validate religious concepts by archaeological finds. Now, it sounds like a contradiction there, doesn't it? The acknowledgement on the one hand that archaeology has done this work to validate the Bible, but on the other hand, you can't use archaeology to validate the Bible's religious claims. Because for these folk, as Israel Finkelstein said, there is a distinction between, you know, facts and faith. Actually, that's Mansour who made that point. And history and tradition and science and religion. And so they make this radical fact-value distinction here that I'm just going to suggest isn't a valid one. I'm not going to suggest it. I'm going to insist it. Because in the case of biblical religion, the facts of the religious claims are grounded in historical claims. Biblical religion isn't kind of out in the clouds somewhere. It's got its feet on the ground, which means it's falsifiable. And by the way, this is how many people have attempted to falsify the scriptures, by showing that they're not historically sound since they make historical claims. So it's by its own, by the nature of the claims of the scripture, it means to be rooted in history, and theological claims are meant to be validated by historical facts. So Jesus claims to be God, and then he rises from the dead in history. That's the claim, at least. And so if it can be demonstrated that he indeed did rise from the dead, then it seems to me it's fair to say that this lends some credibility to his other claims. And the same is true of Old Testament claims as well. If God, in fact, rescued the Hebrews from Egyptian bondage through miraculous events and then destroyed the Egyptian army in the process, well, this, I think, bears on the religious claims that the Bible makes about itself. So what you have here is a group of people who are really good in archaeology, who are making philosophical statements about the appropriate or inappropriate connection between the archaeological finds and religious claims. These are connections that they are not qualified to make simply because they are PhDs in archaeology. What they are doing is bullying. They are saying, we know a thing or two about archaeology, and so we are going to stipulate by fiat the appropriate way to use our conclusions in archaeology, in this particular case, verifying certain biblical events, we are going to stipulate how you use those with regards to religious claims. But you see, when they do that, they are out of their ken. When they do that, they're exercising, they're in the domain of philosophy, epistemology. Now, it may be that their point is accurate, but they are not speaking from their position of authority. Their point has to be adjudicated on different grounds. This is bullying because essentially they're saying we are experts in archaeology and therefore we get to dictate what use is made of the archaeological conclusions that we draw from the data. That they are not in a position to do. And so if somebody tells you, as you are citing some archaeological evidence in support of your theological claim, that the experts in archaeology say that you can't do that, my response is, why not? It certainly can't be because they're experts in archaeology and they declare that it's not appropriate because they are not talking about archaeology at this point. They are talking about something else. And I'm going to want to know why it is that archaeological verification of certain historical events cannot, by their nature, have theological import, especially given the nature of the revelation that Jews and Christians share in their two testaments called the Old and the New, taken collectively as the Bible. That book is grounded in historical claims. Its religious claims are grounded in its historical claims. And it seems if we can demonstrate the history is reliable at many points, that this lends credibility to the other things. And if some archaeologist tells me that I can't do that, well, that's just too bad. They're bullying at that point because they have no authority in virtue of the expertise that they have in their discipline to say that those connections cannot be made. So that's one area where bullying is going on. I'm going to tell you another area very quickly here. One of the speakers at our event that we had in Charlotte was William Dembski, who is essentially the founder of the intelligent design movement. There are a lot of guys that have made really significant contributions, obviously, but he's at the epicenter of the whole enterprise. And one of the things that came out of our discussions together was that the battle is he is fighting is not largely a factual battle, but rather a political battle. It isn't on the merits. In other words, intelligent design is not failing in the market on the merits. That is, the details of intelligent design have not been demonstrated to be noteworthy in the discussion about cosmology or the issue of origins, particularly in the Darwinism debate. But rather, it's the politics of it that are really the issue, such that the intelligent design approach to the question, raising it, the issue, offering it as a model, and asking whether there may or may not be evidence in the natural realm that would support the intelligent design explanation for biological development. This is not defeated on the merits. It is merely dismissed. It is run off the field. It is not allowed to be spoken. And in fact, those who identify themselves even in the slightest way with intelligent design, if they even suggest there might be any legitimacy to this, they get severely punished. And the reason that this is the case is because the academic world operates to a high degree on prestige. And Darwinism has all the prestige. And this is where all the money goes. And any version of intelligent design is dismissed as creationism and is considered by those in academia as incredibly lowbrow. And they do not want to be in the slightest way associated with anything as stupid as intelligent design. Now notice that they are not responding to the merits of it, because they're not even allowing it to have a place at the table so you can discuss the merits. There's something else going on here. It's philosophical, because materialism is the philosophy of the day in the academy, and there's no room for anything else. And if materialism is true, then something like Darwinian evolution has got to be true by simple default. There are no other possible options. And so if it turns out that there is any question raised about Darwinism, about the project itself, not about the details, a lot of discussion about the details, but not about the project. If the question is raised about the project itself, this is a threat to the entire materialistic paradigm. Because if there's something wrong with Darwinism at its roots, that means there must be something outside of the materialistic paradigm that better accounts for the development of the biological realm. And this, they are unwilling to even countenance. And this is true not just with secular institutions, it is true with Christian institutions. Christian institutions, major halls of learning of Christian thought, and I'm talking about the major Christian schools in our country, will not countenance hiring somebody that believes in intelligent design, because they do not want their reputations sullied by something so ignoble. So I just want you to keep this in mind, that when you send your, you know, little Christian student off to a Christian college or a Christian university, you are most likely, and there are a few exceptions, Biola would be one of them, but you are most likely sending them into an academic environment in which they are going to learn theistic evolution. And they aren't just going to learn it like as a matter of education, like here's this idea. They are going to be taught it as fact. Now, you ask around, and you see if that's not the case with the Christian school where your student your little Johnny is going off to. By the way, this has wild and wider ramifications on other worldview issues. Notice, by the way, when they say ID is not science, and this is really the attack. ID is not science, it's religion. That this is not an assault on the merits of the ideas. It is saying that it is disqualified because of a label they attach to it. The implication is, since it's religion and not science, then it's not true. The implication is only science tells us the truth about the world, and religion just gives us faith proclamations. But Frank Beckwith has pointed out, and accurately, that when you say that's a religious argument, that's an inappropriate way to challenge it. The proper way to challenge an argument is to say that it's unsound, or that it's invalid, or that it doesn't follow from the evidences. To say that it's religious doesn't address the merits, and so it misses the point. It's kind of a sophisticated ad hominem, just calling it a name to dismiss it. ID isn't science, it's religion. Listen, science is chock full with intelligent design elements. Archaeology, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, forensic science, even experimental error or fraud, that is detecting the error of the experimenter or detecting the fraud of the experimenter, is an exercise in science of intelligent design, the ability to see intelligent, the hand of intelligent intervention, if you will, that has messed with the statistics or the data. All of those are a legitimate part of the field of science. So why is there zero tolerance, even in pretty much broadly all Christian universities, for the idea of intelligent design? It's completely political. It's completely philosophical. It has nothing to do with the merits. It's just another example of bullying, of people who are in the know and who have the power, who are declaring by fiat, you can't say that. We won't hire you. We won't publish your article or your paper. We won't give you tenure. We won't give you any grants. We will run you out of town. Not because of the merits of your idea, but because of the ideas that you propose to begin with. The ideas you simply put on the table for academic consideration, you will get punished for that. It happens all the time. So you have bullying going on in the archaeological realm. You have bullying going on in the biological, Darwinian kind of realm. And I just want you to see it for what it is. Bullying is bullying. It isn't may the best idea win. It's just running the idea out of town because you have the power to do it. That does not serve any good purpose whatsoever. Certainly it doesn't serve the purpose of truth. I'm Greg Kokel, taking your calls 1-800-227-5278 here on Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17th, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with our trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason. Show us Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kunkel giving you something to think about every week here. Sundays 3 to 5. Make that 2 to 5. Gee. It's been 2 to 5 for the last three years or so, and I'm still not used to that, I guess. So many years we had a two-hour show. Let's see. One other thought on my opening reflection on bullying, both in the area of the archaeological academic community and the scientific academic community as it touches the question of origins and ID, intelligent design, and Darwinism. The question of what science is, notice I mentioned that the kind of the club that is used to disqualify ideas to say that ID is not science, it is actually religion. No, I don't care what some judge in Dover says about it, all right? This is not a legal question. I mean, ultimately, they can make a legal judgment, and then it has legal ramifications for what can be taught in school. I'm setting that aside. He gets to tell you what's going to be done in that way, but it is not his province as a legal thinker to distinguish between what is scientific and what is not scientific. And it is not even the province of scientists to do that. Science doesn't tell you what science is. Philosophy tells you what science is. It is not a scientific question. Therefore, scientists are not in the best position to tell you what science is. They can tell you what they practice, but that doesn't mean that they are the ones who get to define what science is, and I'll tell you why. Very simple. Because science first has to be defined before it can weigh in on anything else. You have to know what science is before that thing can begin speaking about something else. So before science is defined from the outside, there is no science to say anything about what science is. Point being, what science is a philosophical question about science. It is not a scientific question. And scientists, on balance, make really bad philosophers. Now, what they can tell you is this is what we do, and we don't do that thing. Well, that's fine. But if then they start demanding that what they do has to be the way it is, that's bullying because they're working outside of their province as scientists at that point. No, it has to be defined from outside, discussed from a philosophic perspective. That's a different fight. And by the way, you're not going to get support from philosophy by and large. Simply looking at science as a knowledge discipline. You're not going to get support from philosophy that science can only address event causes, things caused by natural law. By the way, we know that's true even without addressing philosophy, because we have intelligent design elements, as I pointed out, in the practice of science anyway. Plenty of room for that. All right, let's go to the phones and our first caller from Las Vegas, Nevada. Nathan, hey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. It's good to talk to you. This is probably like my third time.
In a row. Well, I'm glad you called back.
Hey, thanks. I just wanted to give a quick plug, though, for your store at Santa Reason, because there are some extremely helpful resources there. My wife and I just listened to the Berkeley lectures, and we're currently going through the Decision Making in the Will of God series.
Mm-hmm.
And that is invaluable.
Great.
I can't tell you how much that's helping me.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And by the way, yeah, that second one, lots of people have told us at Stand to Reason, in fact, that this has been really life-changing for them. And in fact, it is the material that more people have said that about than anything else we produce, the decision-making, the will of God. There's a companion that goes with that that actually I did afterwards. You might want to consider when you finish this. It's called From Truth to Experience. Truth to Experience. And it carries some of these ideas out in a little more general fashion. We cover some other bases with that, too. So you may want to consider that as well when you're done with the first one. But thanks for that endorsement.
For anyone who's listening to the radio show and don't want to scratch a little deeper, they really should, because that's really helpful.
Thanks.
I was thinking about the success rate for exorcisms with Catholics, and mm-hmm. I don't know what the numbers are for their particular success rate, but even if it were low, that means that Catholic priests are able to take spiritual authority over an evil spirit mm-hmm. and command it to leave a person.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is there merit to Catholicism? Can someone be a Catholic, do all the extra biblical things like praying to Mary, praying to saints, being absolved of sins by a priest,
mm-hmm.
and be right with God enough to have spiritual authority?
Mm-hmm. Let me answer the question this way. Let me go about the answer this way, and because I think there's a broader thing at play here. And let's just say with exorcism, you have, Assemblies of God, Pentecostal, and mm-hmm. you have kind of a John MacArthur-type evangelical, all right? And there are two very, very different views about the nature of the baptism of the Spirit and the legitimacy of spiritual gifts, all right?
Okay,
and both are able to cast demons out successfully. What does that tell us about the legitimacy of their parochial doctrines? In other words, those doctrines that they hold uniquely from each other. What does it tell us about the validity of those parochial doctrines?
I don't know.
Well, the answer is, I tried to set it up so it would be pretty obvious. The answer is it can't tell us anything about the legitimacy,
right, well, yeah,
because they are both casting out demons. I mean, we're just going to stipulate that they are bona fide exorcisms in both cases, and they are both casting out demons, though they have opposite views of the issue of spiritual gifts and the baptism of the Spirit. And therefore, the casting out of the demon is not serving then in the function of verifying peculiar doctrines. The casting out of the demons by both is in virtue of their bona fide spiritual authority as believers in Jesus Christ. Okay? Do you see that point?
Yes.
Okay, so I could say, let's just for the moment treat Roman Catholicism as a separate denomination. So there are Baptists that may cast out demons effectively, and there are some Roman Catholic priests that are casting out demons effectively. So by parallel to the earlier example, does this end up giving affirmation to the parochial doctrines of Baptists versus Roman Catholics? The answer is no, for the same
right.
reason. What it shows is that in those cases where there is a bona fide exorcism that takes place, that it is done by the power of Jesus working through that person who has an appropriate faith in Christ. So all it ends up proving, I think, or minimally what it shows, is that the person wearing the collar is speaking with bona fide authority in Jesus, for Jesus, which means that he has a bona fide faith in Christ, which I don't doubt is true of many Roman Catholics. I even think that's true of some Baptists. It's kind of a joke. I mean, there are. I think there are true believers in every legitimate denomination of Christianity. That is, that hold to the Orthodox doctrines, and there are true non-believers in every one of those as well. I do think we could say more than simply that regarding these parochial differences, whether Roman Catholic or Pentecostal or Baptist, and you know I've weighed in on these at different times. I'm simply answering the basic question that you've offered. If there are some successful Roman Catholic exorcisms, then what does that tell us about the legitimacy of Roman Catholicism? And my answer is, it doesn't tell us anything about the legitimacy of Roman Catholicism as a whole, just like it doesn't tell us anything about the legitimacy of Baptist theology taken as a whole or Pentecostal theology taken as a whole. What it does, I think, confirm for us is that the individual that was performing the exorcism had a bona fide, genuine faith in Christ that allowed him to exercise the authority of Christ in the exorcism itself.
Okay. Well, then, I guess then the next question.
I mean, I'm not even saying that Roman Catholic priests actually do exorcise demons, or and even if they did, it doesn't validate maybe the ways they go about this. And you see it. I don't actually know how exorcisms work in Roman Catholicism, and in the movies you see them brandishing crosses and sprinkling holy water and things like that. And I have no reason to believe that any of that has the slightest bit of difference in the spiritual realm. But it may be the thing that's making the difference is the authority that the believer who's wearing the collar at that point actually has in Christ in virtue of his faith in Christ, not in virtue of the holy water or the crucifixes or anything like that.
You know, that totally makes sense. I guess I suppose there was an embedded assumption in my question. How much can, I mean, because obviously I'm a non-denominational. I don't, I go to a Calvary chapel. I said that the last time. But, you know, I'll hear definitely warnings against praying to Mary and doing some of the things that that Catholics do. Mm-hmm. So what...
And I think those are appropriate warnings personally. You know, that's a different issue,
right,
but I think they're...
So how much of that can actually get you into some murky waters and get you into trouble? Or is that really all incidental?
Well, I don't think it's incidental. The Old Testament, and this is a whole nother area, but let me just toss this out, all right?
Okay.
And you know, the Old Testament prohibits calling on the dead.
Right.
I have every reason to believe that Mary died. Therefore, calling on Mary is calling on the dead, which is prohibited in the Scripture. Now, I know Roman Catholic doctrine, at least from the end of, I think, the 19th century, held officially, dogmatically, that Mary was assumed bodily into heaven. I don't have any reason to believe that, and so I don't. And but one might argue, at least with regards to the Deuteronomy prohibition, that it doesn't apply to Mary because she never died. But there's another line of argument to raise, I think, that it is appropriate that it is inappropriate to pray even if Mary was assumed, and I think the ultimate and there's a lot more, like I said, that can be said about this, and Roman Catholics have their defenses. I personally think they're somewhat specious, but they do have their way of justifying this, but I think the downside turns out to be that Jesus ends up taking back seat to Mary. And even if some carefully thinking Roman Catholics would say, well, this is not what we intend, what I would say is, but this is what is happening all over the place, and nobody seems to care. That is, nobody in positions of authority seems to care about reining that in when they have an authority structure to do so. So I still hold the church broadly speaking, responsible for those excesses. So, and by the way, there are excesses in Protestantism, too. I understand that. And I think those should be reined in as well, although it's different in Protestantism because Rome makes a different authority claim, and it has a different authority structure. That is, it makes a certain authority claim for its primacy to speak for the church, and certainly their own church believes that, and it is their own church that is guilty of these excesses, and therefore they have the canonical power to do something about it, yet they don't seem to be concerned about that. Yeah, it's particularly in the area of Mariology and Mary, the excesses of the role of Mary in the life of many Roman Catholics. So, I think that that's that's a significant observation. I think there's a fair criticism that's leveled at Rome with regards to that.
Okay, so just whether or not someone's given bona fide spiritual authority, that's sort of a separate issue from their parochial ritual.
All I'm saying is, I'm saying that there's this practice in the Roman Catholic Church that's with Roman Catholics that's way over the top with regards to Mary. That even if you don't take the Deuteronomy passage the way I did, it's still over the top, okay? Even if Mary was assumed into heaven, it's still over the top. And the Rome's defense or Roman Catholic defense is, well, this is what some people do. We don't encourage that. That isn't our official view, but this is, some people just get carried away. And my response is, look, it's not some people, it's lots of people, and you're in a position to do something about it, and you guys don't. Now, that seems to me to be telling. So I'm not persuaded then by the claim that this isn't the official position of the church. That's basically my point there. All righty.
Okay.
Nathan, I got to run to break here, okay?
Okay.
I'm sure we'll have another opportunity.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll have another opportunity to talk. Let's go to break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your calls on Stand to Reason. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ, and that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Are Mormons Christians? Hi, this is Brett Kunkel, and this month on my podcast, you'll hear what the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, had to say about this question and why it's an important question. Subscribe on iTunes to Just Think with Brett Kunkel, or look for it on the podcast page at str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 2 until 5. And it's always a a satisfying thing for me to be here. It's not always easy. It's some people, you know, come visit the show and they say, boy, it went so fast. It doesn't always go so fast for me because I'm working hard to try to give you good, thoughtful responses. But it's always satisfying for me, and I deeply appreciate that you listen and that you're calling in and asking good questions. And it's really important. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. Let's go to Isaac in Hawthorne. Hey, Isaac.
Hey, Greg.
Hey, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
First off, I just want to say thank you guys for your ministry and to everybody else who's making use of it. It's a really, really satisfying and cheerful thing, I think,
good.
To be able to actually start supporting. And so I encourage anyone who's making use of the website and the podcast and the, you know, all the material, that if they can give back so we can keep these guys on the air.
Well, I love calls like that, you know, telling folks to belly up. That's good. Belly up to the bar. I should not belly up in the water. But Isaac, you're like a college student. Is that right?
I am.
Yeah, okay. So thanks for supporting
Standard Engineering. But.
All right. But I was making the point that even as a college student, you're kind of giving back to Stand to Reason. We appreciate that. Thanks. What's on your mind today?
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about the nature of God's love, and I had a question about that. When we talk to each other as this human individual mm-hmm. talking and saying, I love you, there seems to be a lot of an emotional kind of touchy-feely, fuzzy type of, mm-hmm. you know, intonations with that or connotations with that. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that's the same way with God, that he has an emotional side to his love, or whether it's more of an active, more like an action.
Right.
Like
right.
an emotion.
Well, when it says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, some people read that the way that God loved was that he acted by giving his son. And so that would be love in action. I should say love as action, not love as emotion. Others
right.
read it that God had such a strong emotional feeling for us that this compelled his behavior, or at least it grounded his behavior of sending his son. And so there's two different ways of looking at it. I actually think it's both. That is, God's love is expressed in action. And so the evidence of God's love is an act of love by, for example, sending a son. That's just one of many examples. But I also think that there is another element. And now this is a little bit of a debate on a more refined philosophical or theological grounds, or at philosophical levels, I should say, on the nature of God's emotions. Christians, the rank and file, we just think of God emoting. You know, he's happy, he's loving, he's angry, you know, as if he kind of goes through these different phases. And so
right.
he might wake up on the wrong side of the cloud or something, and then, okay, Israel, you're going to get it today, or, you know, or something like that. And that went, I think, on more refined levels of thinking about these things, this is probably not the way it happens. In James, it says that in God there is no variation or shifting of shadow. The classical way of putting this is that he's immutable, that he is unchanging. And some take this to mean that he is impassible. And that word means that he is without emotion, because emotions by their nature are things that are shifting and changing. And I think this is a difficult thing to resolve, partly because some will argue that the language that we have virtually everywhere in the Bible about God is analogical. That is, it doesn't describe God directly. It describes something about God by analogy. And so there's a sense in which we can get it, we can be moving in the direction of understanding what this quality involves, like the arm of the Lord, you know, is strong on our behalf or something like that, you know. So we've got this figure of speech. We know God doesn't have body parts, but we kind of get a picture of what's going on there. Some would argue that all language is analogical because God is so other than we are that there's no way we can know, in a sense, precisely or with a univocal kind of statement. That is a statement that has only one way of understanding it. It gets us right to the heart of it. That the best that can be done, since God is so other, is that He can tell us about Himself by using a language that is familiar to us, that kind of moves us a little closer and in the right direction of this quality of God, but doesn't capture the quality in its entirety. So there is this debate that's going on. I would say that the language of God's emotion tells us something real about God. And I think the fact that He is using language like wrath and love, and He's using emotive language, suggests that when we think of God as having emotions at least somewhat like we have them, then we're in the ballpark with God. Now, it might be that these emotions don't go up and down. So, like, one day He's angry and the next day He's happy or something like that. Because being God, He is perfectly happy all of the time. Because, you know, He's perfectly fulfilling His nature. He's exactly as He should be, as it were. And so we don't want to think of Him having all these shifting emotions all the time. But and it's hard for us to imagine how God could have a steady state of wrath regarding sin and guilt, and a steady state of love regarding the same individual who is His creation, the one who He created out of love. It's hard for us to imagine that because we don't experience that quite the same way. So these are the kind of maze that we have to navigate when trying to be more precise about what we mean about God's love and the other things that are emotions that are described in the Scripture. And so I'm not quite sure what to do with this. I just kind of move a little closer to it. My own way of dealing with this is I say, well, God is different than us, but we're kind of like Him because we got these similarities that are kind of similar, and we know what these things are, these feelings and wrath and anger and love and jealousy and things like that. And so there's a sense in which we can kind of get in touch with that, but we're still not right on top of it. We're still, you know, not going to be able to get it just the way it is. And I take that is because of our finitude and our creatureliness.
Right. Well, and I guess you would think that it's to say strictly that it's only like a verb, like His love is
no, I wouldn't. I wouldn't say, well, they're both verbs. I mean, when you say God loves us emotionally, that's still a verb, but I wouldn't say that it is merely a way of labeling an action, so that when God acts in a way that is for our benefit, we call acts for our benefit acts of love. I think there's more to it than that. I think that the act for our benefit is motivated by something in God that we call love, and it is akin to our experience of the emotion of love, though God probably experiences it differently than we do. But it's kin. That's the most that I can say at this point.
Okay. Well, and that actually does clear it up, at least towards the beginning of, you know, looking at it, just because someone was like, well, you know, don't always feel like God's mad at you for, you know, sins that you have to, like, when you're doing devotions, kind of.
Well, I can answer that question. I can answer that question, and that comes from Romans chapter 5, the first couple of verses. Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with, or maybe justified by grace, whatever. Being justified, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have received our introduction into this faith in which we stand, and we rejoice. So the peace that we have with God, that is, we're not at war with God anymore, God is not angry at us anymore, is a reason for us to rejoice, is what Paul is saying in Romans 1 and 2. And this is not the peace of God. It's not our feeling of peacefulness there in Romans 1. It is the lack of conflict. So I can cite Romans 5:1, and I can say, even though I might be thinking God is mad at me right now, he can't be mad at me in the sense that we normally think of the word, because he already took all of that anger out on Jesus Christ. Nice little way to end our first hour, Isaac. Thanks for that call. Hour number two just ahead on Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
We got the set in, sunshine, fresh air, we got the team behind us, so let's play two.
Welcome to Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel, your host here, and glad you joined me today. I'm looking forward to talking with you. The number, of course, 1-800-227-5278, and there's room on the lines for those of you folks who are just joining in this, our second hour of the show. I started out the show by talking about bullying in the area of archaeology and the area of science, and you may be interested in those comments. Go to str.org. You can get the podcast for that, and if you would... you can also go to iTunes and get it there as well. I want to start out this segment as you're getting in the queue here, 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code 754-4150. I want to speak to an issue that's come up the last couple of weeks. One of our resident atheist callers, Ian, from Florida, has raised the question about the legitimacy or the authority or the reliability of the Bible based on language in Genesis 6 through 8 about the nature of the flood. And his complaint is that the indication of the text is that there was a global flood. And from where he sits, this seems completely implausible and raises all kinds of difficulties. And therefore, he does not take the text seriously. It is not reliable, and it is not the Word of God. Now, I respect the objection, and we had two segments last week and the week before that where we talked a bit about this particular issue, and I promised I would do some more research and get back, which I have done. But the first thing that I want you to notice is Ian's reaction to his understanding that the Bible teaches a global flood. And I want to note that some of those who hold, say, for example, to a global flood, do so because they are convinced the Bible says that this is what happened, and that if you don't accept that interpretation of it, then you are undermining the authority of the Bible. Now, I understand their point. I just want to make the observation that for Ian, at least, and I'm sure many, many others, it is precisely that reading of the Bible, in this particular case regarding the flood, that undermines the authority, that actually undermines the authority for him. So instead of sticking with this interpretation to establish the authority of God's word, it is this interpretation that for Ian and others actually undermines the reliability of the text and gives him, for the moment, gives him comfort in thinking that the Bible is not, in fact, the word of God. So that's just one observation. Sometimes, by clinging to our interpretation because we think we're being faithful to Scripture, we end up having the opposite impact with skeptics than we want to have. Now, it may be that some will say, well, I don't care about the skeptic. What I care about is God, and I want to be faithful to the Scripture from God's perspective, and I respect that entirely. But what's at issue here, to some degree, is what exactly does the Bible say on this matter? And I had given some general responses to Ian in the last couple of weeks, and one of those was that it may be that this flood that is described in Genesis 6 through 8 is not a global flood, but rather a local flood that might be called universal in its intended extent. If you were going to kill all the termites in your house, you could say that it was a universal success if all the termites in your house were killed, even though there might be bugs in somebody else's house. And by the same token, if the goal of the flood was to kill all human beings, then it was universal with regards to this class. That is, all human beings died. So you might call a local flood a universal flood in that it totally encompassed what God intended the flood to do, that is, to kill all humanity. Now, in principle or theoretically, this is an alternative. And, of course, a lot depends on what the text itself says. Does it allow for this? But what I said to Ian is that if it turns out that there is textual evidence that allow for this understanding of it, then the Bible doesn't actually teach a global flood, but it teaches something that avoids all of the objections that you just raised. Therefore, you would be able to raise the flood account as an example of a biblical inaccuracy that then undermines its credibility with you. So that's the line of thinking. But I had to go back and do some studying myself to find out what does the text actually teach, or is it univocal, like there's only one meaning, or is it equivocal? There are a couple of different ways of taking it that are legitimate in the text. And certainly, as I read from the text that he cited, which was Genesis chapter 6, verse 17, excuse me, and behold, the text says, I am bringing a flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which there is breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. And he pointed out that this is pretty straightforward and seems to be unequivocal in its language. And so my question then is, what does this passage actually mean? And in order to answer the question, or at least to lay out the possibilities, I want to introduce you to two important concepts. So these are broader notions that will serve you well, I think, generally in your Bible study, that I'm pressing into service in this passage to see if it does any work for us. And here are the two notions. The first one is range of meaning, and the second one might be range of revelation. And I mean, like here, are there any other texts that might help us to understand this one? And there's a very, in a certain sense, simple set of principles in play here, principles that you and I are fully acquainted with in everyday language. And one of them is that generally, any given word or phrase or statement is not limited to one possible meaning. There are very few statements that we make that are univocal, univocal, one voice. that they clearly say one thing and they cannot possibly mean anything else. Most of our statements are univocal. I'm sorry, are equivocal. They could mean more than one thing. And when we make statements that are obviously equivocal, we say, hey, that's ambiguous. It could mean this, it could mean that, or it worse, it could just mean be vague and we don't even know what you mean. And so we ask for clarification. We have a liability when we go to Scripture that was written 2,000 to 4,000 years ago and translated in modern language. We've maybe overcome the language translation thing. It could be translated accurately, but for some reason, ancient readers read it differently than we read it, even those same plain words. And how would we ever know that? Well, we know that by this second principle, the range of revelation. That is, we want to see if there are any other texts that either use this language, in this case like on all the earth or under heaven or something like that, or that speak to this circumstance that can give us more information about whether the passage could have more than one meaning. And in fact, this is what I've done, and I did take the suggestion of one of our callers and go to reason.org. Is it reason.org or reasons? Let me look. It's reasons to believe website, reasons, plural, reasons.org, and looked up a couple of pieces. And I actually have found some things that were quite remarkable, and then actually did some more analysis just for myself and saw something that stunned me. It turns out that the language that we see in Genesis 6:17 that it describes the extent of the flood, we see popping up in other places. Either the exact phraseology or phraseology that is very much like it. For example, in Genesis 41:57, we read that all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe in the world. All the countries. That's all-inclusive language, right? What could be more clear? But Genesis 42, verses 5 and 6, clarifies that the famine had spread throughout the whole of the Egyptian empire and the land of Canaan. In other words, we wouldn't say that all the countries included, like, China, necessarily. Famines usually are local anywhere. They're not global. So we have what appears initially to be all-inclusive language, but then we realize in a later clarification that it's referring to all of a specific region. And of course, this shouldn't be surprising because we use this language ourselves. We say there's not a cloud in the sky. But we don't mean that on the entire globe there is no cloud in the sky. We mean in the sky that we behold. This is language, the language from the point of view of the observer. And why would we expect the text to be any different? Well, it isn't. There's one example, and here's another one. 1 Kings 10:24 declares that the whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. The whole world. Well, are we to think that people came from Antarctica and Greenland and China and the Hawaiian Islands? No, I think we all can agree that this is absurd. It was the civilized world that was within the reach of the Jewish Empire at the time, and indeed, this seems to be the case as we read. Acts 2, verse 5, Luke describes the Jews living in Jerusalem as devout men from every nation under heaven. Really? Mayans? Aztecs? Chinese once again? Australian Aborigines? No, that isn't the sense of it, and I don't think any of you, when you read that passage, thought that was the case. These were Jews from all kinds of countries in the vicinity, within the reach of a pilgrimage, that were coming and celebrating the High Holy Days there. Colossians 1:6, all over the world this gospel is bearing fruit and growing. In the birth narratives, Caesar Augustus sent out a decree to tax the whole world. Again, expansive language that we don't take to be global because we understand that it's speaking about everyone within a smaller geographical area. And this we see all the time. So based on the language in general in the Bible, we realize that global language need not imply a literally globally extensive event. And so what we are seeing here is that these phrases have a range of meaning. They could mean the entire globe. That's certainly in the running. But they could also mean a localized area that is the whole area of a smaller perspective. And so just on the merits of range of meaning based on comparing other texts that use the same kind of language, the idea of a local flood is completely, or ought to be, in one's mind. And I'm not arguing for a local flood right now. I'm just talking about the possibilities. The possibility of a local flood ought to be a legitimate possibility on a straightforward reading of the text. And this is really important here, because I am not doing any fancy footwork here with the language. I am just taking the straightforward reading of the text, phrases like upon the earth and from under heaven and everything that is on the earth from verse 17 of chapter 6 of Genesis, and I'm saying that these same kinds of phrases have been consistently used in other passages to clearly mean localized things. And so it certainly, it seems to me, possible, if you are even handed and fair-minded about this, to read verse 17 in that regard. So the tie, in a sense, needs to be broken in other ways. But let me give you another way of understanding the second point that I offered, which is a range of revelation, because not only can we find texts that use the same phrase, and so we can get an idea of range of meaning there, but sometimes we have other texts that speak directly to this issue and give us more information on this issue. And with this, I want to go to Psalm 104. And Psalm 104 is a psalm that is identifying praise to God for his creative acts. And it almost goes right down the line of the days of creation and making statements about that and praising God for his works of power in the act of creation there that we see described in Genesis chapter 1. And let me see here. I'm trying to find it. And here in verse, let's see. I'll start in verse 5 because it's describing the creation of the world here. He, God, established the earth upon its foundations so that it will not totter forever and ever, and did cover it with the deep, that is with water, as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. So this is parallel to, I think, the third day of creation where the waters are covering the earth. Right? You're familiar with that. At verse 7, at thy rebuke they fled, at the sound of thy thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place where you established for them. Now verse 9, and this is, listen to the details. And you set a boundary that they, the waters, may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. Now, I don't know about you, and I may be reading this wrong, and I'm open to that possibility, But it sounds to me like the psalmist is saying, when God separated the land from the earth in the early days of the creative process, that he set boundaries over them that they would never cross again, and they would never, therefore, cover the whole earth like they did in the beginning when God first created. Now, if that's an appropriate way to read that passage, that then breaks the tie automatically on Genesis chapter 6, verse 17, whether it is speaking here of a global under heaven or a local under heaven, because it couldn't be a global under heaven because in Psalm 104 it says that God would never do that. Now, what are the promise with the rainbow? Well, that's the promise that he would destroy humankind with a flood. Again, that's the main point there. And so that's another example of other passages helping to weigh in and helping us to understand this. Now, having said all of that, I want to make one final point about this passage. That, and so far, I think looking at the range of meaning that is verified by the range of revelation, that this could be local or could be global, and then by looking at range of revelation with regards to things that address this issue, it looks like God isn't going to cover the earth with water again after the initial creation. By the way, there's a verse in Job that says the same thing. I don't have the reference right handy here, but there's another passage that reinforces our understanding of Psalm 104. Minimally, I think we have to say that the text does not require a global flood. I'm talking about the text in Genesis. Minimally, the local flood is in the running. But I think I can show you right in the flood account itself that these words do not mean global. And I want you, if you're in your Bibles, to turn to Genesis chapter 8, because now we have the flood abating and the water drying up. And I want you to listen to this language. Verse 5 of chapter 8, "And the water decreased steadily until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains became visible." Okay. And then Noah starts sending out the birds, right? He sends out a raven first, flew here and there. He sends out a dove, verse 8, to see if the water was abated from the face of the land. Verse 9, "But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, so she returned to him into the ark, for the water was on the surface of all the earth." Wait a minute. In verse 5, it says that the mountains were already poking up. And in verse 8, it says that the waters were not abated from the face of the water was on the surface of all the earth. That is a contradiction. Unless, of course, that the phrase "on the surface of all the earth" does not refer to the whole globe, which it couldn't, because in verse 5 it says the mountains are up, but rather to all the earth that the dove had access to, which was the relevant point. That every place that the dove could fly, there was nothing for her to land on, so she came back. Verse 10, "So he waited yet another 7 days, and again he sent out the dove from the ark, and the dove came to him toward evening. And behold, in her beak was a freshly picked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the water was abated from the earth." Wait a minute. If "from the earth" means that there was no water on the earth, then weren't there any oceans ever anywhere? The water had abated from the earth. Everything had dried up. All the oceans were gone then, if "from the earth" means global. But no one reads it that way. the water had abated from the earth underneath where the ark was floating, so that somewhere close by there were olive trees sprouting, and therefore the dove brought the branch back. And then eventually the flood underneath the ark dried up, and that was the earth in view. So right in this text, we have global language, or I should say language that could be taken as global, when it's obvious it's not global, because the whole earth wasn't all dried up. The earth that is in view there was the earth in that vicinity where the ark was. And even in the internal evidence of the chapter itself, I have good reason to believe that it is talking about a local flood that was universal in scope. That is, it took in all the members that it intended to, that is, all human beings save the eight saved in the ark. And they were obliterated by God's judgment. And so it was universal as to its intent to destroy human beings, but it was not global. And look, I commend that to your consideration, and frankly, I don't care whether it's global or local. It just seems to me that local is certainly acceptable just from the internal evidence of the text. It may be demanded by the statement there in Psalm 104 that the waters will not cover the earth after the third creation day, or maybe the fourth creation day, whichever one that is. And if that's even a possible legitimate rendering, then I can take this as the sounder rendering. I'm going to adopt this one because it allows me to sidestep a whole bunch of problems that folks like Ian might raise, the atheist Ian might raise, that give him pause in considering the legitimacy of the Old Testament as an historical text. Two principles there, range of meaning and range of revelation, both that you ought to be using when you're assessing texts like these. To your calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with our trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Yeah.
Greg Kokel here giving you a piece of my mind today on Stand to Reason. And a lot of callers in the queue here, and you've been very, very patient. So let's go and talk with you. Shannon in Columbiana, Alabama. Is that right, Shannon?
Columbiana, Alabama.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. Okay, I wanted to ask about, I listened to a debate between Bart Ehrman and, what's the guy's name, Gregory Boyd.
Oh, Greg
right?
Boyd, yeah. Okay, I didn't know that they had debated, but...
there's a British radio show called Unbelievable, and they have
Yes, I am aware of that show, and I think it's fabulous.
Yeah, it's good.
Because they have, you know, peer review. They got both sides, and they got the best players, and they let them go at it. Greg Boyd's a pastor from Minnesota and written quite a few books, actually controversial on some other issues. But we had him here on the show once regarding his book, Letters to a Skeptic, that is based on letters I think he wrote to his dad, who was challenging him about his Christian views. So what was the upshot with the debate between Boyd and Ehrman?
You're familiar with Ehrman's book, Forged, I'm sure.
I am familiar, and we had Mike Krueger on and talking about that very book. So this was a while back, I think April 17th.
Okay,
Melinda
April,
just posted
it. I'm going to take a note of that so I can go back and look at that.
April 17th, right.
Yeah. Boyd seemed to, skirt the issue of authenticity on some place. Well, no, he didn't even skirt it. I mean, he said outright that, you know, things like the epistles written by Peter were probably pseudepigraphal.
Both of them, or just Second Peter? Because Peter is not really under.
Yeah, I do think that his contention was that Second Peter is certainly not accepted by the majority of scholars.
Well, that may be true. See, and I don't know Greg Boyd's position on this, and I don't know all the ins and outs of authorship. If you listen to the interview with Michael Krueger on April 17th, I think that will help. And by the way, his book, that he co-authored with another author whose name escapes me right now, is titled The Heresy of Orthodoxy. The Heresy of Orthodoxy, and he does a good job going over these issues. And so I commend that book to you. I mean, I can't repeat all or recall all the specific arguments, but I wanted to point out, though, that Greg Boyd would acknowledge that most scholars do not affirm the legitimacy of Peter in terms of being, that would be Second Peter, as being authentically written by Peter the Apostle.
Yeah.
The fact that he says that scholars most don't believe that, first of all, doesn't mean that he believes that it wasn't.
Sure.
I don't know about that. And secondly, it doesn't mean that it wasn't written by Peter. This goes to the tactic that I described in the tactics book called the Rhodes Scholar. What one has to look at are the reasons why people hold that this is not Peter, and to see whether these reasons are sound or not.
Yeah, and I think Ehrman, I mean, he kind of showed his cards at one point in time whenever he accused Boyd of doing theology, and that he, Ehrman, was trying to do history, and if you want to do theology, that's fine, but I'm trying to do history. So, you know, he's got this this non-overlapping magisterium that doesn't really,
yeah,
it only comports with his worldview.
Right, but maybe in defense of Ehrman, this is a question of history, what they're discussing right now. It is not a question of theology. The question is, who is the person who actually penned the letter? And Ehrman is saying that these things were not, we cannot say with reliability that they were penned by the people who the works are classically attributed to.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of books that letters that we don't quite know. Well, specifically the book of Hebrews, the authorship is up in the air, but
yeah,
for the rest of the letters
so...
But for the rest of the letters, there are you know, at least we have some attestation for them. And what he wants to argue is we can't trust any of that.
Yeah.
And what one has to look at are the reasons that he offers and whether those reasons hold water. And as I remember from my discussion with Michael Kruger, he pointed out a lot of the flaws in reasoning that Ehrman brings to the table. Now, I don't know if Greg Boyd was able to exploit those flaws or not, and I don't know Greg Boyd's view on this, but if all he is saying is that the majority of scholarship thinks that, say, 2 Peter wasn't written by Peter, well, that in itself is not compelling from where I sit, because the majority of scholarship are doubtful, are coming from a philosophic point of view puts the text in doubt to begin with, and so they're going to be inclined to want to be dismissive of these texts and find reasons why we ought to dismiss them. That doesn't make their views false. It just is a red flag to me not to trust what the majority believe. Because the majority of scientists believe in evolution, Darwinian evolution, I think for the wrong reasons. So on the merits, I think it fails, and one has to look at the merits in the individual cases of these particular books.
Yeah. Ehrman was very dismissive in the book, from what I understand. I had read something by Mike Lacone. I mean, after I listened to the debate.
Yeah, Mike Lacone is another guy to check out.
Yeah, I was a little, unsettled about some things, because I'm willing to, I would never want to chunk inerrancy, arbitrarily, or even very thoughtfully. But, as far as, William Lane Craig says over and over again, do we still have the historical fact that that God raised Jesus from the dead? But there were some things in it that got me looking pretty hard.
Sure.
One of Lacona's papers was pretty good, and
right.
And just listening to it, one of the things that Ehrman completely dismisses is his secretarial kind of authorship, or dictation.
Yes.
And he's like, even though Paul does it, and it's obvious that Paul does it, there's no other historical evidence that anybody else does.
Yes, this is something that Michael Kruger brought up, and for those not up to speed on this particular point, there was a role called an amanuensis. An amanuensis was like a secretary who took dictation, and this is something that happened on a regular basis in the ancient world, and seems to have been the case at least in some of Paul's letters, and we have internal evidence of that. And I know that Ehrman is dismissive of that possibility, and this is something that Kruger addresses, I think, with some detail in our discussion that we had in April. By the way, keep in mind that Ehrman's MO is to take the evidence for his view and exaggerate it. All right. And secondly, to lean always on the side of skepticism of the classical claim, and then finally to dismiss evidence that is against his thesis. So there seems to be sometimes a special pleading there. He is willing to look at only the evidence that supports his view, be dismissive of the evidence that doesn't, because he approaches the whole issue with a jaundiced, skeptical eye. I recommend for the listeners and for you too, Shannon, to go to str.org and check the blog out. If you do a search in our blog with Ehrman's name, Ehrman, you will get a number of results with links to other things usually that will help flesh this out a little bit for you.
Sure. Okay. Great.
All right. And especially check out that that interview in April. What's the date on that again? April 7th that we had with Michael. Not April. It's March. I'll get the date in just a sec. April 17th. With Michael Kruger, and that'll help out. Hey, thanks a lot for the call, Shannon. Got to go to break. I'm Greg Kokel. More of your calls coming up after this. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. And these three self-directed studies will cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Are Mormons Christians? Hi, this is Brett Kunkel, and this month on my podcast, you'll hear what the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, had to say about this question and why it's an important question. Subscribe on iTunes to Just Think with Brett Kunkel, or look for it on the podcast page at str.org.
Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lade Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Greg Kokel back with you here, giving you something worth thinking about every weekend. 1-800-227-5278 is the number. I want to quickly get to Zachary because he's been waiting so long, and we missed him last week. Zachary, thanks for calling back after you got dissed last week by not getting on the show.
That's okay. Professor Tonis is a good person to listen to. I have him next semester for theology, actually.
Who is that?
Professor Tonis, your guest.
Oh, he was my guest last week.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I have him for theology next semester.
Oh,
so
dynamite.
I'm looking forward to that.
Good for you.
But I called the week before that about my friend Sally, who recently came out to me. I'm not sure if you remember. But I'm calling
a good friend of yours, and then you wanted to know how you should approach the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I'm not calling really specifically about Sally, but I am, I think, thanks to that event, again, looking more into same-sex marriage and SDRs, stuff on that.
Uh-huh.
And so this week I wanted to, I guess, play their advocate for a moment and, talk about arguments from, I guess, equality. I know you discussed one of them generally discuss it in your article, when the bride is a groom, or
right.
The groom is a bride or something.
Yeah, when the bride is a groom, that's right.
Okay. And then you point out that homosexual or gay men and women have the same rights as to marry as any other people.
As heterosexuals, right.
Yeah.
And that is that they have the liberty to marry the, and I should qualify, well, I'll put it the way I put it in the article and then I'll qualify it. They have the liberty to marry any qualified member of the opposite sex that will marry them, you know,
yeah.
And but they don't want to marry a member of the opposite sex. My point was just to say that they have the same, they have the same liberty, but it's actually beyond that, because they have the liberty to quote unquote marry a member of the same sex too. But what they aren't going to get is they're not going to get a certificate from the government, and they're not going to get the kind of limitations or I should say kind of legal involvement with the government as is the case with heterosexual couples. So it isn't that gay marriage is banned. It's just that from a policy perspective, the government has no legitimate reason to regulate those relationships. That's my view.
Mm-hmm. So because I haven't been too impressed by any arguments from equality either. There's one I've heard that I thought I'd share with you because I don't know how much different it is.
Okay.
Informally, it would go something like this. It would be like, all people ought to be given equal rights. At the current time, this is not the case. For men have the right to marry women, but this right is denied to women. And then women have the right to marry men, but this right is denied to men. And so then equality should be made in this country by giving men the right to marry other men and women the right to marry other women. And so I guess their point is that the inequality isn't between heterosexuals and homosexuals, but rather between men and women.
Uh-huh.
Is the
okay? Okay. Now, there's the problem. Here's a question that can be asked. I think, what do you mean by marriage?
Mm-hmm.
That's the question. Now the answer to that, I think, is going to be. It's going to have to be something like, well, the government recognizes this relationship in such a way that they license it for regulating the relationship and for privileging the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in this sense, because that's the thing that's not being done that they want. They want to be able to marry. Well, what do you mean marry? We want the government to give us the same recognition by giving us a license that regulates and privileges the relationship. Okay? And the answer to this issue is the government regulates and privileges a heterosexual union for a particular reason, which reason applies to that kind of union as a group, as a rule, and by nature, and does not apply to any other kind of union as a rule, as a group, and by nature. So it is a comparing of apples and oranges here. And this is really what's at the heart of the whole debate. It is not, simply put, in response to the equality charge. Yes, that is true. There is an inequality after a fashion, but it is not an illicit inequality. It is an inequality that is germane to the nature of the policy position of the state itself regarding marriage. The illustration that I try to give is there is something that is denied every single man that is not denied any woman, and that is the right to have a hysterectomy. And, of course, somebody's going to say that's ridiculous, and I say it is ridiculous. It's ridiculous because hysterectomies don't apply to men. So it is not meaningful to say that they're denied something that doesn't even apply to them. By the same token, marriage licenses don't apply to same-sex unions. They don't apply in two ways. They don't apply as regarding the natural purpose of marriage, and here I'm talking about nature, not the law, but they also don't apply as to the policy purpose of licensing marriages from the government. And by the way, in both cases, it's the same reason, because societies have licensed, that is, privileged and protected and regulated these relationships because there is a natural institution that performs a function that is critical to civilization. And that is that these relationships, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, produce the next generation. And this is why the government has an interest in regulating and privileging those peculiar relationships. They don't have an interest in regulating and privileging any other relationships, like yours and mine, for example, Zachary.
Mm-hmm.
We have a relationship. You're one of my listeners. So the government doesn't step in and say, we're going to privilege and regulate that relationship.
Yeah.
Why not? Because they have no interest in doing it. And when I say interest, I don't mean that they're not curious about it. I mean that they have no stake in the matter. And so that there is no reason for them to step in from a policy perspective. And by the way, and this is why these kinds of so-called equality arguments, I think, are disingenuous. They are arguments that are put forward, and they are persuasive on a shallow level. But when you go deeper, one can make the case, whether it's accepted by others or not is a different matter. One can make the case that when you go deeper, it says that these are not issues of equality because they're relevant distinctions here that make them in totally different categories. It isn't people now that we're talking about. It's relationships that we're talking about. Whether the government is going to involve themselves in the private relationships of people. It's not about equality in that regard. What this is about making a statement to the culture that same-sex unions are just the same kind of thing as heterosexual unions.
Mm-hmm.
So there is an equality issue at issue, but not the one that's being claimed. What homosexuals want desperately is respectability. They want to be seen as being no different in any way than any heterosexual, and their relationships, therefore, no different than heterosexual relationships. But the majority of people in this country do not believe that, and they don't believe that for a good reason. They are not the same. Heterosexual unions are unique by nature from any other kind of same-sex union. And therefore, they should be treated differently. It's curious, by the way, that 20 years ago, the rallying cry of homosexuals was, leave us alone.
Mm-hmm.
Get your laws out of our bedroom. We should be allowed to do whatever we want without government interference. Yet now they are demanding government interference. It's interesting that when the heterosexual world is moving away from marriage and saying that little piece of paper doesn't mean anything, what means something is our commitment to each other, the homosexual world is demanding the piece of paper. Now, why are they demanding the piece of paper? It is not because they can get the group insurance rate with their partners. It's because there is a cultural respectability that goes along with it, and that this is the way that they can be declared by act of fiat by the people who, by and large, do not believe this but are declaring so through the law that same-sex unions are exactly the same as heterosexual unions. They get treated the same, and they get privileged the same, and they get the same word, and the word is marriage. Even when they're treated the same, say, with domestic partnerships, this isn't enough because you don't get the word marriage. And therefore, we're still second-class citizens. You're not a second-class citizen. Your relationship is not the same as a heterosexual relationship with regards to policy issues. And this has nothing to do with one's moral view about homosexuality. It has nothing to do with the Bible. Or I could say it need not have anything. The point that I'm advancing is not a moral point, and it's not a biblical point. It is a public policy point that is based on obvious natural institutions like the union, the long-term union of a man and a woman. And whether or not, you know, some heterosexual couples who get married have babies or not is completely irrelevant to the point, because the point I was making is that these couples as a group and as a rule and by nature do that. And so the policy is made with regards to the group because characteristically and by nature, they produce the next generation. There could be exceptions in that. You don't make laws for all the exceptions. You know, and so my point of view is let's have the law have hands off of relationships unless the law has and the culture has a vested interest in regulating and privileging a relationship like they might have with certain contractual things and that. That isn't the case with same-sex unions. And there's a tip-off here, Zachary, and I'll just have to close with this because we're almost at the end of the segment.
Okay.
The tip-off is when you have things like a month or so ago when New York passed its same-sex marriage law, you listen to the news reports and you pay attention to what the same-sex couples say. And here is what they say time and time and time again. I mean, the last time I listened, it was exclusively this. We are so glad we are finally getting the respect we deserve. This law validates our relationship. This law shows that we are no different from anybody else. But this is exactly my point. This is what they're after. Not a kind of legitimate equality when they have been denied their rights and now they're getting their rights. No, what they are getting is they're getting a certain recognition that declares, again, by fiat, really, that their way of life and their, I will say, proclivities are morally neutral and there is no difference between them, that is, same-sex unions and heterosexual unions. And I think that's nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a serious... I could bring in the moral element, but I need not to make my point. Yet, you know, mark my words, this is an issue that's going to get more intense in the future. And by the way, Amy Hall over at Stand to Reason blogged on this last week, so you can go to her blog and check that out. But this issue is going to be a watershed issue for Christians, and it's going to cost us a lot to stand for the truth. More to come here, hour number three, just ahead. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.
Operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
All right, friends, our final hour here at Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel, of course, your host, and beginning to your calls, 1-800-227-5278. I have a couple of very quick items, 1, 2, 3 for you, that are related to actually earlier comments that I made. I started out the show, that would be the first hour, talking about bullying, academic bullying, that is, in the area of science and in the area of archaeology. And I wanted to recommend because I made a suggestion, I think something about the Exodus and some new things that have been found on that issue, and someone tweeted on this or called in and talked to the enforcer about it. If you get a copy of the second DVD series in the True You training material, Is the Bible Reliable? And this is available at str.org. True You, that is T-R-U-E, and then a U, this is the letter U by itself, True You. It's the second series in a set. The first one was on the existence of God, and Stephen Meyer was the teaching host, as it were, for that. And he is also on the second, Is the Bible Reliable? There are some segments in there that deal specifically with archaeological evidence regarding the Exodus that is very, very compelling. And I think the enforcer blogged on it. Did you blog on it, Melinda? On the Exodus stuff, so you can check that out, do a little search there on the blog. The second thing that I wanted to mention is that I had also, where is this? I had also mentioned in the last hour about the flood, whether it was global or local, and we looked at the passage in Genesis chapters 6 through 9, and we looked at some of the language there, and I gave you two principles of hermeneutics and study that will help you in these kinds of questions. Then we applied them to that passage, and you can listen to that in the second hour's commentary. Something else occurred to me that I wanted to pass on, and that is, where is it that the details of Genesis actually came from? Now, Moses is the one who penned the Pentateuch, that is the first five books of the Bible. But did Moses get the account of Genesis, do you think, directly from God, so God dictated what happened to him? Or rather, was this part of the oral tradition that was passed on reliably, preserved by the power of God, such that Moses did his research based on the information that was available to him, just like Luke did his research on the Gospel of Luke based on the information available to him. Now, I have never really looked at this, but I have a suspicion that most scholars would think the second, not the first, that it wasn't dictated, but it passed on to him in a reliable fashion. So he wrote down what the record actually was that was passed on and what God wanted him to pass on, but it was in the language of the people of the time. And that means then we'd have to ask ourselves the question, when it comes to language like covered all the earth, referring to the flood, is it likely that those who passed that information on, in other words, who authored the words themselves that Moses faithfully recorded, is it likely they were thinking of the globe when they said that? Now, do you realize what would have to be the case for them to think that was the globe? They would have to be aware that the earth was a globe and be characteristically thinking in those terms, and I don't think they were. I think that they were thinking of the earth the way most people did then, when they used the phrase earth, as the area where they lived, or at least where civilization was, which seems to be concentrated in the Mesopotamian region during that time, which is why at the Tower of Babel after the flood, God had to disperse with languages because they hadn't been dispersing prior to that. Even before the flood, it hadn't happened as God had commanded. So there's a sense in which there may be a little anachronism going on here. In other words, people are reading into the account a notion that is a notion of modern people, but probably wasn't a notion that they had at the time. By the way, this is just an additional thought to my broader argument that I offered at the beginning of last hour, but just something I want to attach to it. I certainly would draw my conclusions about the nature of the flood just from that point, but it is one that you need to take into consideration. Here's the third point I want to make before I get to our callers once again, and that number is 1-800-227-5278. We got two people on the line, lots of lines open now, so it's likely I will get to you this hour if you call in. This third element is based on a question that I get more often than I'd like. And that is, what is the difference between a person who believes, a Christian who believes in the old earth, and a theistic evolutionist? This comes up with some frequency because the assumption is made for some reason. And I don't know why this is made, at least with regards to the merits of the views and the nature of the discussion itself. I understand from a sociological perspective why this is done. But based on the issues themselves, I don't know why anyone would assume that simply because somebody believes in an ancient earth that they are somehow committed to Darwinian evolution. Because the only similarity between someone who is a Christian who believes in the old earth and someone who believes in theistic evolution is that they both believe in an old earth. That is the only necessary similarity. So why is it that somebody who believes in an old earth is automatically grouped with theistic evolutionists when there is nothing about an old earth that implies Darwinian evolution in itself? This mystifies me. And so when somebody says, what's the difference between an old earth ID person, intelligent design or creation person, whatever, and a theistic evolutionist, my question is, what's the similarity? There's only one, and it has nothing directly to do with evolution. It troubles me, actually, when people ask this question. I know why they do sociologically, and that's because in certain circles they have been taught that there are only two points of view, and that is young earth creationism or evolution, period. And if you don't believe in a young earth creationism and you are a believer or claim to be of some sort, then you are a theist who believes in evolution because that's the only option. Well, this is intellectually indefensible. People ought to be more apprised of the field of the discussion than that. I believe in the old earth. I do not believe in Darwinism, classically characterized. That is descent with modification, natural selection, working on genetic mutations to move the enterprise forward, to explain the diversity of life on Earth. I didn't believe in any of that stuff. So how could I be called an evolutionist simply because I believe in an old earth? Anyway, just wanted to pass that on. Time to get back to the calls. 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code, local to me, just dial direct 754-4150. And John in San Diego.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Hey, Greg, my question is about the Exodus, but I just wanted to make one comment about your flood topic this afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Last week when that gentleman called you, the atheist from Florida,
Ian,
one thing he said that I wish you would have commented to him, he was talking about the water covering the highest mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And what I would have said to him, and I'm sure you've heard this before, that the mountain ranges were perhaps not as high as they were today.
This is possible,
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't recall you saying that to him, but he was talking about how could the water have covered the highest mountains. And I would have told him that at the, you know, when God divided the continents, that's when the mountain building occurred to the, you know, these 14,000 feet mountains we have today.
Sure, sure. But you know what? God divided the continents in the third day of creation. That's where he set the boundaries to the waters. I mean, if I'm reading that correctly in light of the geology, I think that's what we'd have to say. And Psalm 104 says that after he did that, he set those boundaries so that the waters would not transgress them and never cover the earth again, which seems to disqualify the possibility of a global flood from Psalm 104. But I'm not sure if I would have made this observation that the mountains were lower, if that would have satisfied his concern. Because let's just say that the whole globe is flat, but there's only one, say, 3,000-foot mountain in, North America. Let's just say that that's the case. And everything else is like Florida, you know, a swamp. If the text says that it covered the mountaintops, then it would have to still be global even to cover a small mountaintop. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I see your point.
Yeah, so this is why the adjustment that has to be made, I think, in our perspective is to say that it covered all the mountaintops of the region that was the area where the flood, submerged things, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The area where the flood covered, not necessarily the whole globe, but the localized area. It turns out, by the way, the geology, and this is something else I found out this last week, the geology of the Mesopotamian, you know, Fertile Crescent area, Iraq, Iran, whatever, does allow for a basin that's there that would allow 400 meter deep flood that would have destroyed all of civilization and would have been contained by that basin, covering the mountains, the localized mountains where population inhabited there, but not necessarily covering all the mountains on the extreme outside. So it looks like geologically this could have taken place too. Anyway, that's
well, just finishing up that quick topic. The verse I was thinking of, I know you mentioned God divided the continents on day three of creation.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of the verse in Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, where it says, "And two sons were born to Eber, the name of one which was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided." And that would have been the time, perhaps. You know, some people take that to mean the Tower of Babel, and others take it to mean that the earth was one big continent, and God broke it up into the continents we have today.
Well, that could be. Of course, you want to be careful you don't try to make too much of that kind of one phrase there. It's still pretty ambiguous, but I get your point.
Yeah. Okay, now my question was on the Exodus. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that you heard some evidence recently that supported the Exodus, archaeological evidence, and I've read numerous articles on this through the years, where they'll say things like, well, you know, if Israel had 2 million people wandering through the desert for 40 years, there's never been one, you know, pot or pan or vessel found out there that, you know, shows that they were really out there. I mean, what kind of evidence did you hear concerning the Exodus?
Okay, well, let me answer that challenge first, and there's a couple of ways to answer that. I mean, I guess my general answer is not necessarily so. That is, it's possible to have a large group of people that are moving and still leave no traces, because we have more recent examples of this. And I can't give you a chapter and verse in this. Melinda just mentioned a large tribe of Bedouins or something that had traveled extensively and we know existed, but still left no traces behind. So it is possible to do that, although I'm with you. I don't think that's likely. The problem may be that people are looking in the wrong place. And this is part of the nature of the evidence that at least has been suggested to me, and Stephen Meyer covers in more detail in the True You set called Is the Bible Reliable? Again, this is available at str.org. And I'm looking at my Bible right now, the Exodus route, in one of the plates, the maps in the back, you know. And they have... they have a standard characterization of the route, but and the standard characterization of Mount Sinai. It turns out there is some significant evidence that standard characterization is just flat out wrong, and that it isn't the Sea of Reeds that they crossed, but actually the Gulf of Suez at some point. In other words, the Big Sea, the Red Sea. And not the Reed Sea, and that the true Sinai is actually on the Arabian Peninsula. It's not in Sinai, the mountain where Moses received the Ten Commandments. Now, I'm not in a position to defend that right now, but the point is that there has been compelling argumentation that has suggested that, and if that's true, then the places where you would normally look for those kinds of things are in Arab control right now, and in particular, the area that some think, and I think Stephen Meyer thinks, is the true Mount Sinai, is actually off limits to anyone else, though they have petroglyphs there that could give and other archaeological remains and evidences that could give indication of a significant Hebrew presence thousands of years ago. Now, you can understand, by the way, if that is the case, why the Arabian government is not going to want archaeologists poking around there. I don't want to give an argument from silence, but there are independent arguments that suggest that they're looking in the wrong place, that have some that are compelling, and this is the arguments that Stephen Meyer offers and that I heard some details of the other day. And then when those locations that they think might be the authentic locations are in fact locations that have artifacts on them for which scientists, archaeologists cannot access because of the political situation. So that could be part of the reason, too. People are looking in the wrong place. That's why they haven't found those things. The same thing with Kadesh Barnea. There's like four or five different options for Kadesh Barnea that are possible. And so these ancient locations are not always easy to identify 4,000 years later, or in this case, it would be 3,500 years later, case of the Exodus.
You know, Greg, in 2005, I had a chance to go to Egypt, and we went to the traditional Mount Sinai, which is over by St. Catherine's Monastery.
Correct.
And, you know, they told us when we were there, this is the traditional site, but there's at least 15 other sites that others claim is the authentic. So you're right, they really don't know. Then I've heard, like you mentioned, about the Saudi Arabia area. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you know who Bob Cornuke is.
I think the view that I'm espousing here that Stephen Meyer promotes is the same view that Bob Cornuke has promoted as well.
Right, and that's, yeah, also I'm familiar. Okay, so that's the evidence you were talking about at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, check out Stephen Meyer's True You number 2, Is the Bible Reliable, if you can. I don't have any other references for you right now. Maybe we can make that available later. I haven't checked this stuff out myself, but I had this fascinating conversation with a person who is lettered in the area. He's a professor over at Southern Evangelical Seminary, and he's quite compelled by some of this evidence, and it's really, really fascinating. By the way, this has been an area where there has been a dearth of evidence archaeologically, the whole Exodus thing, and one wonders why is that the case when it was such a dramatic event. And it makes sense now, if people are looking in the wrong places for the evidence, why there might be a big hole there in the evidence. And if more archaeological work can be done in some of these other places which are now restricted, that might solve the problem. Who knows?
Have a good day.
All right.
Have a good day.
You too, John. It's a pleasure to talk to you again. How are we doing time-wise? Okay, we're going to break. And we will talk with Steve in Los Angeles after that, and then more calls, too, at 1-800-227-5278.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species and argues that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Greg Kokel here, contending for the Christian worldview, every Sunday from 2 until 5. The enforcer has just given me a rendering of her blog post on June 23rd of this year. So if you want to go back and check it out, it describes, it summarizes the material that Steve Meyer covers in his True You segment on the authority of the Bible, specifically dealing with the Exodus. And what he claims in his piece is that there are three basic minimal facts. That is, the kinds of things that virtually all in play, all the academics in play, are willing to acknowledge based on the evidence that they do have. The first one is that Israeli slaves were in Goshen before 1446 BC, which is before the biblical date for Exodus. Okay, that's the first thing. Secondly, Israel arrived in Canaan around 1400 BC, and finally, that Israel wandered through, the Jews, that is, wandered through from Egypt to Canaan about the time of the Exodus. And some of the evidence is pretty compelling, including Egyptian household records that date to 1740 BC, listing slave names, including distinctively Hebrew names. There are wall paintings depicting Asiatics dating back to 1870 BC. There are written references, like public work, wall murals depicting Semitic slaves working. There are wall inscriptions in Semitic languages there in Egypt. There's a record indicating Semites held positions from lowly slaves to high ranks in the Egyptian government. So all of these things are pieces of information from archaeology that corroborate the biblical account and give it credibility. Now, it seems to me that the biblical account ought to be given some credibility as an ancient record all by itself, just like other ancient records are, but that's not the case the way this is approached in archaeology. It's a different issue. I talked about that in the first hour a little bit, but there's some basic background information there coming from Steve Meyer's presentation on the True You set of DVDs on the inspiration or the authority of the Bible. So you can check that out at str.org. Let's go to Los Angeles. And Steve, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Yes, sir. Thank
yes,
you
sir.
For the time.
How are you?
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. It's your turn.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Now, 2 years ago, a friend of mine gave me what is called the Visions of Washington.
The what?
And the Visions of Washington.
The Visions of Washington, okay.
The Visions of Washington.
That's not a tour. That's not a tour guide for Washington, D.C. or something, is it?
No, no. It's Visions, you know, supposedly by Washington. In any event.
You mean by George Washington himself?
By George Washington.
Okay.
Yes. And in those visions, it refers to men fighting with angels, and angels fighting with men. Now, this is a situation which apparently, as I read it and understood it anyway, where men were fighting against angels, and angels were fighting with men.
Mm-hmm. You mean with, like, side by side or against them?
Side by side type of thing.
Hmm.
Well, this is what occurs, and the reason I brought it up was I was over in Daniel the other day, and I was in about the 10th, 11th chapters there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know where Daniel had the vision of the angel?
Right.
Coming to him there.
Yeah, and he says he'd been delayed because he'd been fighting.
Yes, because he had been fighting
mm-hmm.
with the angels. And then he got Michael to, you know, come and help. And how does that work? In essence, I mean, men fight with their fists, hands, devices, or whatever. How in the world do angels fight?
Yeah, well, my answer to that particular question is I have not the foggiest idea. And the reason I don't is because they're immaterial beings, and so whatever conflict they have is in the immaterial realm. And I can't imagine what that would look like. I mean, well, I can't imagine something. But what I imagine is people fighting, like with swords and fists and the kind of combat that we have in the material realm. But obviously that isn't the way it happens. But that doesn't mean there can't be some kind of conflict in which spiritual forces or spiritual powers are at odds with each other, and one comes out the victor. We don't have any detail in the Bible about that kind of thing, and so this is one of those things where it's pretty hard to answer the question.
Well, I mean, they're obviously very powerful and terrifying beings. One of them, you know, slew, 180,000 soldiers in one night?
Well, that's true, and this raises some question to me about the Washington Vision kind of thing, because, there are biblical accounts, as you pointed out, about angels or inangels slaying many people. So there's like no contest between an angel and people. And this is why it's not clear to me why you would have men fighting beside angels when it seems to me one angel can pretty much do the job, you know. So what's
very
the
much.
Point of the men in their fighting? And this gives me reason to maybe question or doubt this alleged vision by George Washington about angels. It is possible for an angel to kill a man because...
We know that.
Pardon me?
I said we know that, but angels...
We know that from the biblical record, right. How that happened, you know, it doesn't say. If I were there, I don't know what I would have seen. You know, maybe something like out of Indiana Jones. I don't know. But we do know that immaterial beings can have an impact or make their presence known in the physical realm. I'm doing it right now. I'm an immaterial soul that is moving a physical object called my body. So that can happen. Pardon
me? And the middle is war in heaven, so, I mean, it's just off the top of the head type of question, how do angels fight? You know, I haven't been able to conceive of that myself.
You know, okay, I can't either. You know, I just take it, based on the scripture's authority that there was a conflict here. It's hard for me to figure out exactly what that looks like because there's spiritual forces opposing each other. But I do not, thank you for the call, Steve. I don't, by the way, take the Washington Vision seriously, for one, because it has elements in it that just strike me as really odd. For two, I don't have any independent reason to believe it's really a bona fide vision. And for three, Melinda said that she checked Snopes, and Snopes says nopes. In other words, apparently this is falsely attributed to Washington, so it's just an urban legend, which I'm not surprised about. All right, let's go to Montana, and welcome to the show, Kurt. Greg Kokel, hi.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going? Okay, just to get something before the question, I'd like to have some other scholars on besides Christians on your show, like Bart Ehrman. I'll have you dialogue with them sometime.
Okay, I'll consider it. I don't usually do that, partly because I don't know that this forum is the best forum for that kind of debate. What we've had is, you know, their books, their critiques of their books and stuff like that. So they make their case in their book, and then we have them. Then we have a critic that kind of gives peer review of that.
Yeah,
there are other shows
that
do that. Pardon me?
The only problem I have with that is when somebody listens to your show is they listen to an already filtered version, criticism of it, instead of from the horse's mouth, so to speak. So,
well, okay, I guess that could be the case sometimes. What you're suggesting is that it's possible for people who are critiquing Bart Ehrman to misrepresent Ehrman's views. Usually what we're doing, though, is we are citing the books themselves in which these views are made public. And, you know, of course, you're asking me. I'm going to say I don't think we're misrepresenting his views, but I guess somebody else is going to have to decide, maybe the author, whether we've done that. It seems to me we've been...
That would be interesting, because I think it would be an interesting
show. Okay. All
but,
right.
Okay, and my question. And how do you know that Christians and your view is is the right doctrine you're following.
I mean, you mean as a Christian, the doctrine?
Pardon?
I was just asking for clarification. Do you mean as a Christian, how do I know I'm following the right Christian doctrine? Is
right,
that what
right. Yeah, of all the doctrines. I mean, you're obviously, most Christians obviously are taking off from the Council of, Nicaea and the one after that, I believe.
Well, the councils are places where Christian doctrine or some vital, important, central Christian doctrines are kind of summed up and more carefully articulated, but they are doctrines that are grounded in revelation. So, for example, Council of Nicaea, the principal issue there was the question of the deity of Christ. And though I might make reference to the Council of Nicaea as a place where this was kind of hammered out in more precise terms in light of the challenges that it was facing at the time, principally Arianism, my defense of the Trinity is not from the Council of Nicaea. I'm not going to say I believe in the Trinity because of the Council of Nicaea. I'm going to say I believe in the Trinity for these biblical reasons, and the Council of Nicaea agrees with me, so I'm probably on pretty solid footing.
And well, I think you're arguing backwards. I think Christians argue backwards. It wouldn't be a very wise business decision. I'm not saying this in a disrespectful way to you, because I appreciate your ministry. And
sure, but so, well, okay. Explain what you mean by arguing backwards.
Okay. If Christians decided to say, okay, everything was wrong back 1,600 years ago when they decided what the canon was and what the correct doctrine, Orthodox Christian belief was, well, we're going to go back a little further because we believe they had it wrong. Well, most people are going to go for the most people who are sheep in the church. That doesn't give them a whole lot of confidence in the church and the leaders of the church that they actually got the doctrine right in the first place. So,
well, I think if I said that they were all wrong and I'm going to go figure it out for myself, then I could see that at least initially somebody might say that you're not trusting.
But then that person who does that will automatically be considered a cult, like Mormonism.
Pardon me?
Because Mormonism does that. They believe that they go back a little further and are coming up.
No, they don't go back very far at all. They go back to the last century.
Well, they believe that they're restoring the church as what it was.
Regardless of what they believe, there is no evidence that their beliefs are justified by any writings that go back any more than 100 years ago.
Okay, and that's debatable as well.
Well, I'd like to see it. The teaching of the Mormon Church, as far as I understand, is that the Christianity was so corrupted so early on that was no semblance of the truth until Joseph Smith restored Christianity in the 19th century. I mean, if there was a record of Christianity that was the same as Mormonism that was sustained through history, then there would be no need for Joseph Smith to restore it. I mean,
but,
I don't think
yeah,
that,
I
that
want
is
to
a contentious.
I didn't want to get off on track on Mormonism. I just wanted to say, if somebody did decide to say, well, we're going to go ahead and start from the beginning and just leave all this aside and start from scratch, they'll automatically, from every authoritative voice within Christendom, be considered a cultist or somebody
I don't
the truth. And then, you know, that's. They're not
okay, Kurt, I don't see the need to do that. I'm just take myself. Here I'm a Christian, and I'm trying to figure out what's really true. And I have a history of doctrine that goes way back where the church has held, say, for example, the deity of Christ. I don't have to just throw that in the trash can and start over for myself. What I can ask is, why is it for the last 2,000 years that Christians have thought Jesus was God?
But they did.
Their answer... Pardon me?
They didn't all believe in that. That's why they had these disputes. And when you say that...
Wait.
Okay.
I want to affirm your point, but I want to clarify something.
Okay. All right.
That Jesus was God is the most ancient testimony of the church. It is the most primitive. The statement that Jesus is Lord is among the most primitive statements of the church. Were there people who did not agree with that? Yes, there were some people that didn't agree with that. They were out there on the fringe somewhere, but this was not the test.
Jesus is God in an Arianism sense?
No, well, the Arian didn't think Jesus was God.
When you argue from a Trinitarian sense, because it's not explicitly in the in the Gospels and anywhere else in the New Testament.
Okay,
it has to be inferred that that's the case by reading into it.
Okay, let me make my point so I complete this thought, and then I'll address that very briefly. And that is, given the church has taught that Jesus was God, I'm going to ask the question, well, where did you guys get this? And they said, we got it from the teaching of the early church. And when they said Jesus is Lord, for example, and then it's legitimate to ask, well, what did they mean by that? And then we can look at the earliest writings and see what they meant by that. They meant that Jesus was the uncreated creator. And I find that in John chapter 1, verse 3, among other places. They also meant that Jesus and the Father were distinct in some way, but they were both the one God. These are explicit statements in the Scriptures. They are not implicit statements of the Scriptures. So, and this is true about the Holy Spirit as well. I can show you explicitly where this is stated. So when I see these explicit statements in the Scriptures in these different places, I can gather them all together and see the teaching that is upheld in the 4th century by the church, that Jesus is one essence with the Father, though he is a different person. It's there in the earliest documents, and it's not hard to see. And so, therefore, I see that the teaching of the church has been verified, for me at least, by looking at the earlier documents and the earliest testimony. So I'm not tossing the church out and starting and the councils out and starting all over for myself. I am looking at the reasons that they gave and see that these are justified in the earliest documents. Now, as to your point that, well, then there are other people who didn't believe that, like Arius, that's right. I'm not going to say aberrant at this point. I'm going to say alternate to this point, because let's not make that judgment yet. His was an alternate view that some Christians had that rose up in the 3rd century, became very popular. In fact, it was the majority opinion, before the Council of Nicaea. And it was until the final vote was taken, which wasn't close at all. It was like 318-2. As it turned out, there were only two dissenters. They were both Egyptian representatives. But up until that, there was a lot of confusion about that. But there was not confusion in the early church. And this is the point that I'm making. Those who had alternate views, like the Gnostics in the 2nd century and the Arians in the 3rd century, were those that were on the outside of the mainstream of primitive Christianity. From the very beginning, and this is the strength of the argument, from the very beginning, the testimony that Jesus was Lord, and we know what they meant by that, was part of the testimony of the early church, or the phrase, the Son of God. Paul wrote in mid-50s in Romans chapter 1, the first couple of verses, that Jesus was declared with power to be the Son of God through the resurrection. That is a high Christology within 20 years of the resurrection.
Okay. Well, it's even more complicated than that, because you have to then define what the Son of God.
Now, it's not complicated at all, Kurt. Well, we know what the Son of God meant. It was a claim to deity, which is why Jesus was threatened with execution for saying it. It can be made more complicated, and that's what you're doing, but it isn't more complicated than that.
Well, it is, because there's also Son of Man sayings.
And we know where that comes from, too. It's a divine, it's a reference.
But I'm saying, when you say you know where all these are coming from, that's you're arguing from your camp. There's other...
I am arguing from my point of view because I looked at the text and drew a conclusion.
Okay.
If you're going to characterize that as arguing from my camp because I have a conclusion about it, then every single person who argues is going to be arguing from a camp.
Okay, so my main point then here, what if I was, I believed in Arianism, but I believe just about everything else. I, you know, anti-gay and all that stuff that most Christians believe now. Would I be considered a Christian? Would I go to heaven when I die? Just because I believe just a little technicality that Jesus was a little bit separate from the Father.
Jesus isn't just a little bit separate from the Father on that issue, and it's not just a little bit of a technicality. That's like saying, if I had sex with a woman that's not my wife, would that be wrong based on this little technicality that I wasn't married to her?
It is a technicality, because I think a lot of Christians believe in that view, even though because when they think that... they come to the verses about Jesus praying to the Father. That's very complicated and confusing to think that it's a three.
Until you understand the Trinity,
but then
it's
to be a Bible expert
problem.
to be able to understand it for yourself. Is what
well,
I'm
Kurt, I don't know what to say to you at this point,
but to answer
your specific question, then I'm going to have to move on to a break and then to some other callers. Your specific question just a moment ago was if a person just didn't get this little technicality right about the deity of Christ, would he go to hell? Well, that would mean that he wasn't a Christian, which would mean that he wasn't trusting in the true Messiah, which would mean that he was dying in his sins, which means that he would be judged for his sins, which means that he would go to hell. So God is not throwing people into hell because of a little technicality, but because of a major mistake. They believed in the wrong Jesus, a false Jesus. And Paul said, if anybody gives a gospel which entails the message of the person and the work of Christ other than what I've given to you, which is a gospel that is the Son of God, that is the divine man Jesus rising from the dead for our sins, then let him be thrown into hell. That's what anathema means. So I guess Paul himself has answered the question for you. Got to run to a break. I thank you for your call, Kurt. More coming up on Stand to Reason. Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
Are Mormons Christians? Hi, this is Brett Kunkel, and this month on my podcast, you'll hear what the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, had to say about this question and why it's an important question. Subscribe on iTunes to Just Think with Brett Kunkel, or look for it on the podcast page at str.org.
Does the Christian faith stand up to the scrutiny of critics? Tough scrutiny? How credible is the Bible, and how seriously should you take it? Can you entrust your eternity to its message? Based on Lee Strobel's provocative national TV program, the new DVD series, Faith Under Fire, features fascinating debates and riveting interviews with Christians, atheists, Muslims, and proponents of other faiths as they tackle today's hottest spiritual topics. Lee Strobel concludes each session by offering his own perspective. These two new DVDs, now available from Stand to Reason, include discussions on, is the supernatural real? Is Jesus a prophet or the Son of God? Do all roads lead to God? Did Jesus rise from the dead? And more interesting topics. Guests include skeptic Michael Shermer, critics Edward Tabash, Richard Carrier, and Shabir Ali. Defenders of Christianity include Dr. J.P. Moreland, Dr. William Lloyd Craig, Greg Kokel, and Stephen Meyer. Contact Stand to Reason at str.org or 800-2-REASON to order these fascinating DVDs.
Oh, a happy day.
Happy day.
Oh, a happy day.
All right, final segment here at Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Greg Kokel just finishing up here with our final caller in Melbourne, Texas. In Texas, and this is Melbourne. Is that your name?
Yeah, that's Melbourne. You don't get to talk
Melbourne, okay. It sounds like a city to me, but...
Like Melbourne, Australia.
Uh-huh, okay. So Melbourne in Texas. You don't sound Australian, so...
No, I'm not. I'm an old country boy. But I got a lot of learning, though. What I want to talk to you about. One thing I want to say, is that your little boy on the intro? Did Hollis go, all right?
No, that isn't my little boy. I don't have a little boy.
All right. We'll just quit that question then. The evidence of the deluge, you see, I was, Ted Gordon Armstrong gave a sermon about 20 years ago about a worldwide flood, evidence of a deluge flood, and he gave... Mm-hmm. Stated facts about, well, he stated there were facts about a Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still there. I'm listening.
Okay, my phone's kind of beeping. But anyway, like Shark Tooth on mountains next to California, and like the, let's call it Big Pit there in Arizona. Oh, yeah, the Grand Canyon. Yeah, and there's evidence of, a large amount of water flowing in there at one time and burying oceanic creatures and such as that.
Yeah,
Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I'm aware of fossil graveyards. I'm aware of shark tooths and, you know, other kind of ocean fossils that are at great heights and stuff. There are other explanations for those than a global flood, and one of them is that the fact that we have plate tectonics, we have movements of the plates, and we have mountaintops being pushed up could account for that kind of thing. I mean, it certainly is consistent with the idea of a global flood, but this is part of the concern that I have, you know, about it. It's fine if you hold to a global flood, then you identify evidence that is consistent with a global flood. That's fine to do. But because you have evidence consistent with a global flood doesn't mean you have evidence that has proven that a flood took place, a global flood took place. And I listened to a presentation not long ago about Mount St. Helens, for example, and it was a very impressive presentation. It was fascinating what happened with Mount St. Helens with the explosion and then what happened afterward, this canyon that's carved by rapid erosion, this wood that gets fossilized very quickly, and there were some other things that happened there that were remarkable, and that if viewed in other geologic formations, one would, or I should say, if viewed absent from your understanding of the short time it took for that to happen with the explosion of Mount St. Helens, one would have assumed that this took a long time to happen. I think coal was created and everything. And so it was a fascinating presentation, but what I think the presenter presumed he was doing was giving evidence against Darwinian evolution, and this was an evolution versus creation conference that I was speaking at along with him, and that he was giving evidence against evolution, that he was giving evidence in favor of special creation, and he was giving evidence in favor of a young Earth, and also in favor of a global flood.
Well, I think it's possible for a global flood or just a regional flood. You know, our God is mighty. You know, I'm just a simple man, but, you know, I believe he's able to make it.
I think God is able to do that, too. But with regards to this presentation, there was nothing in the presentation that turned out to indicate that Darwinian evolution did not happen. There was nothing in the presentation that led to the conclusion that the Earth was young, and there was nothing in the presentation that led to the conclusion that there must have been a global flood.
Speaking of Stephen Meyer, he was great on that film Expelled.
Yes, he was. He's great on just about everything, in my opinion.
That was a wonderful guy. Can I ask you a question about, you know, like plain facts overlooked? Like, why do we have a 7-day week cycle? Why come it ain't 10 or 12? You know, I read a book recently, you know, and it kind of gave me the impression that God did not allow man to interrupt this 7-day cycle because the time of Earth, when he created in Genesis, it took him 7 days. Now, he made... let man fight over, you know, his little thing about the last
time. I can't tell you the historical reason why our calendars are broken into 7-day cycles. I don't have any reason to believe that it's because God did not allow us to do otherwise because of the 7 days of creation.
Yeah, God created the world in 7 days, and we still keep the 7-day cycle. We don't have a 12-day week. We got a 7-day week.
Yeah, well, we do have a 7-day week, and that is one understanding of the Genesis passage, but it doesn't strike me that the fact that we have a 7-day week is proof that the days of Genesis chapter 1 are solar days.
One fact that I think it throws into, out of question is that, you know, that the Sabbath day, you know, being a seventh day, and that God proclaimed the one day to be holy, and you know there's a big argument over that.
No, I understand. I understand that rationale, and I think that that's a reasonable argument. All right, and I think that holding that the Genesis passage teaches a 7 solar day creation week. I think it's a reasonable and honorable view, and I think it is defensible from the text. I don't think it's the only view of the text that is defensible, but I think it's an honorable view. And
I
think
really
that the rationale that – hold on just a second. Wait, Melbourne, wait just a second, because I wanted to respond to your 7 days and the Sabbath thing. And I think that that passage from Leviticus, I think – also dovetails nicely with that interpretation. I think it is also consistent with the view that it is that there is a that in Leviticus what there is a proportional thing. In 7 quote unquote days or 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth, whatever those days mean. And in the seventh day, whatever that day means, God rested.
Yeah.
And so then he's established this regular weekly pattern for the Jews. So there's a proportion that's there rather than necessarily a correspondence with exactly the same kind of solar day that we see in Genesis 1. I think that's another way of looking at it that is legitimate. So it's not a slam dunk there for the young earth creationists. But I'm with you. I think it's a legitimate.
Say again, I'm sorry. Don't you think that it is significant in our day and time that we are still keeping a 7-day calendar, you know, without letting man, you know, have changed it like they did the Sabbath day?
Yeah,
they changed it from the seventh day of the week to the first day of the week.
Right.
And I bet you know the story about how that happened.
Well, I know something about that, but you asked me specifically, don't I think it's significant? And, simply put, no disrespect intended here, I don't think it's significant. That is one thing that I do not think is a sound argument for that view, though the others have respectability. Thank you for the call, Melbourne. And I just want to clarify a comment I made a few moments ago about the Mount St. Helens presentation that I saw, as fascinating as it was, and if I believe everything that was told me about what took place, and I have no reason to doubt it, the integrity of the presenter or anything of the facts, just because in Mount St. Helens, within a very short period of time, a fossil can be made, does not mean all fossils were made that way. Just because in a very short period of time, coal can be made at Mount St. Helens does not mean that all coal was made that way. Just because a canyon can be cut in a short period of time because of the unique circumstances of Mount St. Helens does not mean that every canyon is cut that way. And this is why I said that there was nothing in that presentation that seemed to indicate or dictate that evolution was false, that there was a young earth, or that there was a worldwide flood. Those details are interesting and they are consistent with it. But then to draw the conclusion that because it happened at Mount St. Helens, that this explains all the geological data that looks similar to it, is not legitimate. What you have to do is you have to look at the specific individual circumstances. And I can go north here in California from Los Angeles, and I can see layers there and upthrust. And you separate the layers, and in the separated layers, there are fossilized raindrops. Well, you're not going to get fossilized raindrops in layers that are rapidly laid down by sedimentation of a flood. That's something that's going to happen over long periods of time. You got to look at the individual circumstances. Well, that's our music, friends, and that means the end of our show. Thank you for participating, and I do appreciate you listening and calling in. I want you to go to the website, str.org, for our featured article. It's called A House with No Walls, and in it I explain why an assertion is not an argument. This will help you in your discussions with other people. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.